deep in the heart of the Welsh valleys, a young man had a deceptively young and unfathomably handsome man had decided that it was his destiny to become the greatest dog agility handler the world had ever seen. So he set about learning his craft. His front crosses were crisper than a dry December morning in the Brecon Mountains. His catchkers were slicker than a boiled pigeon in a rubber tube sock. The intensity, accuracy and speed and natural flamboyance he brought far surpassed anything the sport had ever seen and would ever likely see again. The time was approaching where he would be ready to shine on the world stage and begin his legacy. But he realized, to win any battle, you must first know your enemy.
Welcome along, everyone, to another episode of Know Your Enemy, and today we have the one and only Greg Derrett. Greg probably needs no introduction from myself. He's been in the sport for a long time, and for that whole length of time, he's been winning. Greg has now moved into the management role for Team GB, who have recently just returned from their most successful international season to date. I really enjoyed the conversation with Greg, and I hope you guys do too. Before we dive into today's episode, I just want to give a quick shout out to our sponsor, the Karma Fitness Academy. If you've been thinking about taking your fitness to the next level and you compete in dog agility, then this might be the website to suit you. Karma Fitness Academy is your one-stop destination for top-notch training and resources. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting in agility, we've got something to suit you and the goals that you are aiming for. From specialized courses down to personal training, there is something for everyone. Even if you're just looking to improve your quality of life, there's plenty on there for you. All can be accessed to suit your own schedule with minimum equipment, and every session is led by myself on a pre-recorded video that you can follow at your own convenience. So if you've been debating it and you haven't been sure how, then the website might be worth checking out for you. We'd love to have you in our community. www.karmafitnesswales.co.uk. Thanks again to the incredible community that allow me to make these podcasts for all of you. Now let's jump into today's episode. Okay, welcome along again to another episode of Know Your Enemy, and this week we have Greg Derrett on. So Greg, do you want to say hello?
Hi, nice to see you all. Hi Chris, how are you?
I'm all right, mate, I'm all right. So, we all know your name now because I have done such a spectacular introduction, but to yourself, who do you see yourself as today? How would you describe yourself?
Describe myself as today? In agility, I've been a competitor for 30 years, I guess is probably the main thing I've done. More recently, I'm GB manager. And then the other massive part of my agility life is my business, which is running agility events and organizations. So I ran UK Agility in Great Britain for nearly 20 years, and we've sold that back in last year. But my main work now is UKI North America, where we've got around 1,000 events a year. So I guess that sums up in agility.
Yeah.
In a very short few sentences.
Fairly involved then, so we say. So you said briefly that, you know, you've been doing it for about 30 years.
Yeah.
How did you get into it? And kind of give us a bit of background on it, kind of thing.
Yeah, so as a 12-year-old kid, friend of my parents had a litter of pups that were meant to be purebred golden retrievers, but a border collie down the road jumped in the kitchen window and got there first. So these purebred retrievers turned out to be all black dogs. So they basically went from having a full list of homes to having no homes at all. And they were close friends. My mum kept their horses there. So I used to go up there every day, sort of fall in love with pups. My parents let me have one. They told me to go dog training if I was going to have one. I had to, you know, look after it and be responsible and all that kind of stuff. So I took it to a local dog club. Without sounding too arrogant, was pretty good at it. Progressed very quickly. Was beating adults very fast in obedience. When she was about, you know, sort of a year old, people said you should do agility. Went down to the agility club. Started doing very well there. And yeah, that's really how it started. Started competing, started winning. And as a early teenager, when you're winning and beating adults, it's quite an addiction. You get the, I've always been to football and playing football, and you know, I was an average footballer, I would say. Suddenly agility, I was one of the best in the country, sort of mid-teens. And that is addictive. And it just kept going, really.
So you got into it at a young age. Did you kind of always know straight away that it would be something that you'd always be involved in, or did that kind of gradually grow as you got more competitive and more successful?
I think by the age of 16, 17, I was fairly obsessed with competing and training. I was always into animals. You know, I was a classic kid that wants to become a vet, but isn't intelligent enough. I knew pretty quick. And as a 16-year-old, I started training people. And as a 16-year-old, I was making pretty good money. So, yeah, I would say from certainly as I went through my A-levels, I was pretty sure that I was going to be heavily involved in agility for the foreseeable future, I would say.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And that I didn't quite know what it was going to turn into, but I knew I was certainly going to pay my way through university teaching people. You get, as you get your next dog, you've already planned the next 5 years, haven't you? So, I think my second dog I had when I was 17. So at that point, I'd already planned, I guess, the next 4 or 5 years that I was going to, you know, I got her as a pet primarily, everyone does, but you know, there was also agility in the background. You know, I went for pure red border collie. That was that was, I guess, a big step as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And at that younger age, when you first started, did you have any mentors, or did you kind of, were you kind of self-taught? I know later on you went into more formal education on it, but give us a bit of background with that.
Yeah, I think initially, you know, I had club trainers, a couple of guys that are still about. One's still posts regularly on Facebook, and he's still very, very traditional, old school methods. We won't go into that, but that they taught me some basic dog trainer foundation stuff that's probably still true to today. But they were only sort of, I guess, by 14, 15, I was self-teaching myself and trying to work out what I could do to beat the top guys. And back in the day, there was people like Dave Blackshaw and Sandy Bell and Dave Hurst, Mary Ray, sort of Leslie Olden, those names, and looking at, all right, how am I going to beat them? They were the top guys that I wanted to beat. And that, you know, arrogant, competitive teenager kicks in and you're like, right, I'm going to beat them. And trying to figure out how to beat them was sort of myself. And initial training, but pretty quickly on my own, but always looking up to, you know, the top names and what were they doing and how could I not only compete with them but try and beat them, what could I do better than them, was always the goal.
So with regards to agility as it is today, obviously you're still involved as a competitor and as a coach and as an organizer, all of those things. But yep. I'm sure you'll agree that it's kind of changing rapidly, and it definitely has so within the last, I'd say, 4 or 5 years especially. Obviously, I can't go back as far as you, but you've seen big changes. So where do you feel it's heading towards now, and how will that look for the handler and the dog?
Yeah, I mean, people will say it's more competitive now, which I personally don't agree with. I think it's a different type of competition now. There used to be a lot more friendly competition, but I would say in the mid-90s, it was some seriously competitive. There was a lot of sportsmanship going on back in those days, all the way through to what people see now. I think where it's changed so much in the last 5-6 years is obviously our jump heights have changed dramatically.
Yeah.
With lower heights for all dogs, extra heights, and obviously course design has changed beyond recognition in the last 5-6 years, I would say. I mean, COVID, I think when we've come back from COVID, we've seen another massive change on the direction of course design. Where that will go in the future, I think it will get to a certain point as we've increased speed and distances, and then it will come back a bit. Personally, I think we're probably going to go too far the other way before people then realize that maybe we've got too much speed, and then the course design reverts back a little bit more to slowing or more clever design to try and take away some of the speeds that we're getting. I think there's a balance that we haven't yet hit. Some judges have, I think, but there's a lot of judges that haven't yet quite hit that point, where they're still pushing the boundaries, which is cool. You know, that's how everything changes, and the boundaries get pushed until we find out where the limit is, and then we come back. So personally, I think in the future, courses might just slow down a little bit. I think there'll be, safety is becoming much more talked about. I mean, it's been talked about forever, but actually now people are far more proactive. I also think, probably without being too political, I think people use the safety argument too much to get things that they personally want for them and their dogs. So they shout out the safety word. I think we could do with a lot more research to find out what is safe and what isn't safe, but there'll never be the money in the dog world that there is in like the horse world. So I think there may be some changes to equipment. I think piece of equipment like the A-frame might change. You know, that's probably the one that causes most injury, I would suggest. Whether that will be lowered and that kind of thing, I think we'll also be looked at. Possibly equipment go in, like the wall, the tire. You know, I can see that being lost. There's people with more safety concerns.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing to always look for more safety, but as you say, it needs to be done with research showing why as well, rather than just continuously looking to take things away. Let's find out why and then maybe make amendments to it rather than just straight up take it away.
I mean, I think we're controlled a lot by opinion on social media, and that can be very powerful, but it can be also be a unscientific opinion that someone's thrown forward where others have got on the bandwagon, and suddenly we've got campaigns happening which might not necessarily be actually for the good of the sport and for the good of dogs. So I think that's also something where we have an issue in dog sports, because social media is our main our main like viewing of people's opinions, but quite often you only get one opinion and no one else wants to stand up with a second opinion.
Well, you get shouted down if you have an opposing view when you're on the first person is always the one willing to get their head chopped off, isn't it?
Yeah, the loudest voice isn't always the right voice. Yeah. Something that agility needs to be aware of.
I think that's in everything, not just agility, though, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So if you were going, like, obviously, you know, at a foundational level, dog agility is all about the training of the dog. And I know you're big into that side of things. So before we start having a look more internationally, because obviously you're now the GB coach, domestically, what do you think you see that people have the biggest misconception of with regards to dog training in the UK that you think should be addressed and could be addressed quite easily?
I think probably the biggest misconception is speed is formed by out of control dogs.
Yeah. Do you want to elaborate? I know what you mean, because I had a podcast with Kamal not long ago and we talked about similar stuff, but I'd like to hear your views on it.
Yeah, I think dogs that understand behavior are faster, and speed comes from understanding. It's my sort of my core belief on all my dog training has been that, all my agility, that if I get my dog to truly understand something, it will be quicker. Same as a human being. Once we understand something, you know, let's take something as simple as like knitting. People that knit really fast understand it, you know. Someone that's learning knitting is very slow. And it's that basic muscle memory behavior that you're looking to try and establish. So I think people move too fast through the early understandings of behavior, so that dogs don't truly understand it, because their main focus is to get more speed. So we want speed. So we do everything really fast where the dog is just sort of running around crazy and not actually thinking. So I think that transfers across to pretty much every element of dog agility. And if you go and stand at a competition ring from grade one through to grade seven, you'll see dogs that truly don't understand what they're doing. They might look fast and people will say, wow, that dog's so fast, but it obviously often has a really slow time on the clock because it's actually not performing behaviors efficiently.
It's more, so is more arousal versus drive, really?
Yes, and understanding. I think, you know, you get drive to learn behavior, and then you teach accuracy of behavior, and then speed will come. I mean, Susan Garrett's acronym of DASH, you get drive, you get accuracy, you get speed, and then you put it in different habitats. You know, I think that's one of the best dog training sayings that anyone can ever follow. You know, let me get drive to get the dog to work for me. Let me teach it the accuracy of a behavior, speed of the behavior then follows, and then I need to put it in all the different environments it needs to perform in. You know, that's kind of something that everyone should follow, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing for definite. So we're talking about training from domestic point of view, but I know I've spoken to you about this before, and I just thought it was an interesting one, so I want to bring it up again. Obviously, I was on the GB management team with yourself. Now, currently, you're still there as the GB management, and this year you've just come back from the EOs with was it a record amount of medals?
Yeah, I think it's more than double what we've ever won so far. So yeah, I mean, I think the cool thing we've had this summer so far is that the juniors won more medals than any other country, and the seniors at the EO have won more medals than any other country. And I think that's the first time we've ever had the most medals at any event in 20 something years. So we did it twice. Now it's only a start, but it actually shows that it's a successful year, whatever now, but it also shows that we do have the capability in this country. Quite often you hear about, we're not as good as Europeans. Well, we are. We've proved that now. We just need to do it on a regular basis.
Yeah, so good progression. That's the one thing we'd say. But like, I know we've talked about it in the past, and like, always use the Germans as the top of the pedestal, the ones that we need to, because in the past they have been the most successful ultimately. So what do you think, firstly, what do you think they were doing, or what do you think they were better at than everyone else? And then secondly, why do you think we were able to close that gap? Because we clearly have.
Yeah, I think the Germans have, first of all, they're phenomenally consistent. And I would suggest that they've probably trained their dogs well. So their dogs understand their behaviors better than anyone else's, which therefore they increase their speed. So they get their consistency of behavior, and that the speed then follows, you know, from an outsider looking in. I remember a World Cup, probably around the 2015, 2016 time, and Tobias was, I think he got two medals. For whatever reason, he came in to do a lap of honor with two dogs, and he put one dog in a weight on the podium, just a criteria stop, whilst he did a lap of honor, and the whole crowd was cheering as he ran around with his other dog. And I just remember thinking, what's impressive is that his dog, he's put in that atmosphere, complete trust that it's not going to break its criteria. And at that point, I remember saying to teammates, how many people in GB could do that? How many people could put their dog in a criteria position, in 5,000 people screaming and cheering whilst he runs around the ring? And so personally, I think they, you know, just that little thing I just remember sticks with me. Just because I thought, yeah, those guys know what they're doing with dog training. They understand behavior, they understand criteria, they must understand rewards to get that kind of simple behavior, but actually quite a difficult behavior in that environment. So I think that's what the Germans have done. I think they've got, where they've got a good team spirit, I can't comment on because I'm not in it. What they do have is depth of high level people. So when one goes wrong, there's another one to win behind them. And I think that's where we haven't had, and no other country really has. If our top person messes up, we don't have another person of that level. So where I think we've improved is in a couple of our heights, definitely, we've got three or four now top quality, high level people. You know, for example, Dalton and then Ewan and the intermediate this year, I felt that both would get on the podium if they got it right, which was, I think, took pressure off maybe the management team around them, because they knew that if one messed up, there was still another one that could get the medal. Yeah. And there's also a couple of other dogs in that height that, you know, I think Lee got six, and Marita would have certainly been top 10, if not higher, with if she hadn't got Ed right at the end. So we certainly got dogs in there thereabouts. And I also then think on teams, when you're on a team and you're abroad, atmosphere is crucial. And when you've got one person doing well, that gives a better feel in the team, and then other people do well. Whereas if you've got lots of people going badly, it escalates and the whole team starts to suffer. And I think the Germans probably benefit from that, because there's always a feel good in their camp, because they've got so many good people. There's always going to be one or two doing well, and that then transfers to those others. But I also think that's where we've stood up. We've now got dogs in every height that are competitive, and teams in every height that are competitive. And therefore, there's a feel-good atmosphere in the group. And there's not a huge amount of negativity where, oh, here we go again, we're going to lose. It's like you when you watch England football. I know you're Welsh, but you know, you've obviously seen England's a far better team than Wales. But when you watch England, you just know it's going to go wrong. Like, we've just lost the World Cup with the ladies, women's team, and you just knew we were going to lose that World Cup final because England, you know, and it's that feeling. And I think when you've got more people in the camp that know that, you know, winners, it just helps everybody do better and better.
Well, it's like you say, winning is kind of a habit as well, isn't it? And if you start winning more regularly, then that expectation, it does grow, but I think in a helpful way, because it's like, well, we've done it once, we know we can. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Rather than, oh my God, we never win. That attitude is almost self-fulfilling, isn't it? Because you never win, you never think you can, and because you don't think you can, you don't plan accordingly, you don't prep accordingly. And because you don't do any of that, you ain't going to win. It's the saying, it's like, if you think you can, you will, and if you think you can't, you won't. You've got to believe it first. Yeah. And I think getting over that line, like so many did this year, fair play to them, is a massive step in going the right direction and making it so that it becomes a more consistent thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. I think self-belief and confidence, I'd like to think that, you know, as a management team, we're doing a few things that are just changing culture and changing attitudes. And I think all that kind of thing helps everybody, to believe they can win, and also the determination, you know, let's not think, oh, it's good enough to be at the World Championships and run and put a social media post up that, wow, look at me, I'm on team. Let's make people realise that means absolutely nothing. And what actually really counts is performing at the World Championship. And that's not necessarily getting a medal, but banging in results that show that you performed to the best of your ability at the World Championships. That's what you should be posting about. Not posting, I'm going to Czech Republic, but it's posting, I went to the Czech Republic and I was as good as I could be. And I think that sort of change as well will help us.
But I think that level of accountability as well, in that knowing that you have, because it's a bit of a throwaway statement, isn't it? A bit of a cliche, oh, I did my best. But if you actually take it for what it is, and you actually did do your best, then that is all anybody could ask. But what you've got to be is true to yourself and say, did I do my best? Did I get everything in place that I could possibly have done to do my best? You can't just say I did my best and then kind of be and use it as like, oh, well, I did my best. It's more like, no, I did my best. I prepped, I got ready, I did the training, I did the research on the judges, I went out there, in all of it. Absolutely. You have to actually do your best. You can't just say it, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's something that, I think the reason I've been fairly successful through my career as a competitor and also in my business is that it's never good enough. You've got to have that attitude, well, what could I have done better? And I think that's something that perhaps I brought into the team about, okay, well, what could we do better? And when you say you've done your best, I'm going to challenge you to say, well, did you? And I think that's taken me a couple of years for people to realize that, oh, actually, I've got to perform. Otherwise, you know, the management team are going to be looking, saying, well, you didn't, and therefore, am I going to pick you in a future year if you don't perform? You know, what other sporting team could you say, well, last year's performance doesn't matter? You tell me that Gareth Southgate, picking his England team, doesn't look at their previous performances playing for England. Of course he does. And I think that's something that we need to do as well, so that everyone knows that you're always being assessed. It's not just about the tryout, it's about, you know, how you perform for your country and when you perform, and not even the performance on the day, but how you prepared. Were you doing the right thing? Did you do everything in your power to represent your country to the best of your ability? You know, were you making the right decisions 8 weeks before the competition? You know, were you making the right decisions in your prep, how you traveled, all that stuff. Basically, no excuse culture is obviously, as you know, we pushed a lot that don't give me an excuse, because you shouldn't have made that mistake in the first place, or certainly you shouldn't do a second time kind of idea.
And I think as well,
which is a bit,
I think as well as the fact that you said earlier that you used to play football, I think being in a team sport prior to agility gives you a different outlook on competition in itself, and kind of promotes the importance of being a good teammate, when often in agility that isn't a thing. You're always in it for yourself, which, you know, it is on a week-to-week basis, you're in it for yourself. But when you go abroad with Team GB, you're part of a team, and that attitude has to reflect that. I mean, I don't know how you see that side of things.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the problems with agility, is a very selfish sport 99% of the time. You know, it's you and your dog, and no one really cares like you care whether you do anyway. Maybe your other half does, but, you know, there's very few people that are really invested in you and your run until you, that one time a year or twice a year where you run for GB. And then suddenly you're invested. I mean, especially now we've lost Crufts teams. There's not even that. We don't really even have an event now in Great Britain where you're encouraged to be part of a team until that one day at the EOs on the Friday. Suddenly, this is the first time of the year that you've actually been in a team. And obviously, you know, you're running with people that you are competitive against for 364 days a year, which is also very difficult. If you look at most teams, you know, people are together as a team permanently, so we do have a kind of weird sport with that. But certainly, I think, you know, playing football before, and I mean, I follow football, I follow rugby, and I think that helps with the understanding of selections and performances and team cultures. And, you know, what would a football manager or rugby manager tolerate, and why would we be any different as an agility manager in those kind of scenarios? And I think people that don't follow sport probably do struggle to have that understanding. But I'm hoping it's something that we can bring into GB gradually, that, you know, we are a team, and we need to perform as a team, but we need to behave as a team. And it all counts, the standards we set, the same as any big sporting team.
Yeah, for sure. And I think as well, I don't want to speak for you because I'm going to ask you now, but I mean, I've been a manager of a big team, the Welsh agility team, and like, you've got to make decisions that are going to upset people, haven't you? Because someone isn't going to be selected and someone isn't going to be selected. And to be honest, it's a good thing if that person who isn't selected is upset, because at least it shows that they care and they believe in themselves and all that good stuff that you want in a team. What do you find? Well, firstly, is the management role that you've taken what you expected it to be? And then what do you find the hardest bit about it?
Yeah, I think where it comes to selections, yeah, definitely I've been on the other end of obviously selections, good and bad. I know how it feels, and I know at the time you can't always be black and white and think, yeah, that's a good decision, especially when it's gone against you. At the time, you should be upset and annoyed. In hindsight, we look back at decisions that went against me. They were probably fair enough, to be honest. They were grey. I gave grey areas to a manager to make the choices. And I think the big thing that anyone who wants to make teams and believes that they should be on every team is they shouldn't give us grey areas. It's a black and white. It should be obvious that we pick you. And that's the challenge, is that some people will never, they'll always have a bit of a tainted view of their own brilliance. But their results don't show it, or their performance doesn't show it. And that's always going to be an argument, and that's always going to upset people. I mean, the classic this year, without going into specifics, but one of the events, we've got 12 choices, and we've made our 12 choices, and probably people that know can work out what that's for. But I've had 8 people think they should be in those 12. So that's now 20 people that have actually really believe they should be in the 12. Well, the eight are disappointed because they believe that, but whichever eight I dropped from those 20, that is what it is, isn't it? You know, there are only so many. We can't let everybody do everything. So you have to make choices. There's some clear cut obvious ones, which probably everybody in the country would make the same decisions as me. And that's cool. But if you've got any selection where another person can argue an alternative, then you know that someone's going to be upset.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like we just said as well, it's like kind of you, if you're competing at the highest level, you've got to have a certain level of belief that you should be. So it's only to be expected that the eight who didn't get picked think they should be picked because, you know, you're in Team GB, so you're obviously doing something right. And then to go that extra step and say, well, I think I should have the individual, it kind of makes sense. I mean, I'm sure you'd agree because you've been a competitor, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's the same with I should be in team, I shouldn't be in team. But when you look at team selections, you're not just looking at what the result says. You're looking at, okay, well, there's the three other people. Are you going to gel as a team? You know, is your attitude throughout your agility showing that, you know, you'll make decisions for a team, or are you very much self-centered? You know, there's times in team where you have to go for the slowest clear round and look like you've got a really slow dog. Who cares if you win a medal? But there's a people out there that would never do that because they never want that PR of, oh yeah, I was 3 seconds off the pace. So, you know, they're not an ideal team person. They're an individual person. So there's all sorts of things that go into team selection that until you've been in and around it, it's hard to always comprehend it. But it's a complicated pick that we have at times. And it's also hard to justify some of those and not upset people. Because if you say, well, you're not a very good team player, there's no real proof of that except, you know, well, your behaviour shows that. You know, but you can't, it's not a black and white definition on that. You know, whereas if you say, well, you had a fault and that dog didn't, okay, well, there you are. We're using the result sheet. So there it's clear. Even though people put excuses as to why they had the fault and the other person went clear, you've still got a black and white argument. But a lot of times in selections, you don't have that. You have multiple factors that aren't always easy to define.
I get where you're coming from. And it's a kind of a thankless situation where, like we said, someone will always be a little bit upset by it. So let's have a look at things from a competitor's point of view now. Let's have a look at judges and course design. Obviously, like we say, you run your own organization and are responsible for picking judges for future events, that kind of thing. So who are your favorite judges with respect to course design and just as judges? Who do you like to run under?
Who I like to run under and who I like at my events is possibly different. I think some of the big names in the world of judging are there for a reason. So if you take, you know, someone like Peter Pupik, who's just judged for WO, takes judging to another level. You know, the effort he puts into his course design, the effort he puts into his judging on the day, you know, how he has warm-up routine and a warm-down routine, you can call the way when he judges, you know, 20 minutes before, he's completely getting into a zone. After he finishes judges, he takes 30 minutes before, you know, he comes back into sort of normality of talking to you. He's very, very focused on his judging, which I think is brilliant. It's so cool to have someone that professional judge for you, because you know he's doing everything in his ability to make sure he's as good as he can be, not only what he's designed, but also actually during his span in the arena, making decisions. So guys like him, I've got a lot of respect for. You know, there's guys that are leading the way on course design. You know, Jan McGill and Tamas is well known. So those are all guys that are going forward. We've got a lot of good upcoming younger judges, as in younger as in newer judges. Daniel Walks is one of them, for example, from Germany. Marco from Finland. These are guys that I think coming in with cool design ideas that are slightly different, but also sort of, they're not, you don't want a judge to come in with ideas that are so far out it causes controversy. You want guys that are challenging people, but still creating good courses that are fun to run. So, but maybe with a few sort of slightly novel ideas that, you know, that's like different designs to make people think as well. What we don't want to do is go down the route of having judges that set up stuff that everyone can get round and everyone likes, because then it becomes a bit boring. You want a few challenges in there, and you want the best people to sort of shine on the courses, and for the skills that they've got to beat the people that haven't got the skills. And that's always a balance with judging, obviously. But yeah, those particular guys, I think, are good. Keane has recently come forward. He's a really good judge and really good course design, and puts a lot of thought into a course design. You know, the judges that are writing stuff and justifying what they're doing, I think it's also cool to see that they're actually, you know, they're arguing why they make these designs. They're not just doing them, they're actually justifying their designs. And I think that's really important for our judges.
Yeah, you get to see the full process behind it almost as well, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. They're not just like, oh, I'm just doing it because it's popular. They've got a philosophy nearly on why they design courses and how they design courses. And when you talk to some of these guys like that, it's incredible the level that they think about on course design. And that's why they become who they're becoming in dog agility, I think, because of the amount of thought they put into it.
Yeah, I agree. Kind of from a competitive point of view again, then, is there anyone who you watch and enjoy watching because you like can appreciate the amount of time they've put into it as a partnership? Is there anyone who you particularly look out for running, or is it kind of just a few different types of people that you enjoy?
Yeah, I mean, it depends who... what role I've taken on today. Am I taking on my...
Yeah, I knew that's what you'd say, which is why I kind of kept it vague. I'd say from a management point of view, because I know that as a competitor, you're not going to want to say that you want to be like someone else. So from a management point of view.
Yeah, I mean, Dalton Clippy at the moment are just a league above everybody else, I think. When those two, Dalton and Clippy, get it right together, they're just impressive. I mean, his EO final run a few weeks ago, you know, I was obviously standing on the start line with him, and it was just a phenomenal run in under that pressure, running last or second last, whichever it was. I think he ran last actually, with the pressure, knowing that I've got to put not just a run in to get round, but I've got to put a winning run in, and it was just a phenomenal run. So watching, you know, partnership like that, and that's just pulling Dalt out, but you know, Ewan and Crazy and Martin Selfie and James with Willow, you know, they all put in runs that day that were a pleasure to be part of, because they really, really went for it, meant it, and performed. And it's as a manager, it's great to see that they're stepping on the line with that, also with that belief in themselves, which is quite cool for those guys. That, you know, all four of them that pulled individual medals, you could stand on the line with them and think, yeah, you guys, you know, I had a feeling that all four were going to pull it off, which is really cool to be part of. But people coming through, you know, you're looking for, I mean, I do watch around the rings and keep an eye on who's likely to be making team in future years. And you're looking for people that stand out with good dog trainers is one of the main things that I like to see, that I think they've got a good brain on them as well. You know, they're not just running around fast and doing every single run, they're making good decisions. You can see the maintain criteria, they, you know, contacts and start lines and that stuff. So those things make me happy when I see people actually being good dog trainers as well as good competitors.
They've always got a chance then, haven't they? Right, so...
If you're a good dog trainer, you can always fix something when it goes wrong. Yeah. If you've got somewhere and you're not a regular dog trainer and your four-year-old dog starts to have issues, which they all will, let's be honest, there's very few dogs that go through a career that don't need dog training to fix stuff that's gone wrong, and or as courses change, we need more and more dog training. So if they've not got those basic dog training skills in that dog or in themselves, you know, they're probably going to struggle as we get to the 4 or 5 year old mark where they're actually coming onto team. So I think that's that's quite an indicator that you might make team, but you might not last on team because you're not good enough dog trainer.
Yeah.
If that's sounds a bit brutal, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do.
You can see them heading up. Suddenly that dog that you thought was going to win you a medal actually now hasn't got a start line and they're not going to be able to fix it. You know, that it's that kind of longevity you're looking for.
Yeah. So on the podcast, one thing that we do now is the previous guest asks the next guest a question without knowing who it is. So your question from the last episode is from Kamal, and he actually name checked you on someone who inspired him to first get into agility, which you possibly don't know. I don't know. But he's asking, if you could choose one dog to run on the world stage to win an event, who would it be? And I'm guessing by previous answers now we can possibly know already.
Okay, so I was going to take a dog today that I felt I could win with. I'd take Clippy.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a surprise after what you've said, but I mean, she is a phenomenal dog, isn't she?
Yeah, I mean, she's gifted, but I mean, she's also got a, I mean, you know, a it makes it sound like taking away from Dalton when you say it's a phenomenal dog.
Oh, no. I definitely don't mean it like that either. Yeah. I mean, he's done the training, hasn't he? But
I think, you know, Dalton's created that dog and he's created that partnership. But yeah, if you could take a dog, and you also know she runs for someone else other than the owner, so it'd be a dog that you could probably, if with a bit of, you know, bonding with, you could probably get a good result. Whether I'd be good enough now to run a dog that fast, I'm not sure. I'm too old. But, if you're gonna grab a dog today and that was competing at that level, yeah, I'd pick Clippy at the moment. And that's quite cool for us as well, because I, you know, 2 years ago you'd have picked Crazy, and I'd still be pretty happy to run Crazy. So
yeah, she's still right up there herself, and she's
nice. Yeah, it's nice that we, you know, GB's got two dogs that straight away I'd be like, actually, I'd probably pick those two over any other dog in the world, personally, currently. So, yeah, that's quite cool for GB to be able to say that, I think.
Yeah, cool. We're going to go into the quick fire round now, okay? Just give us a quick answer. You don't need too much background on it. What did you have for breakfast?
Coffee.
Just coffee?
Just coffee. That's all we drink is coffee.
What was the last thing that you Googled?
I was looking at dog supplements.
Dog supplements, okay. When did you last sing and what song was it? I know you're famous for your karaoke now, but...
What did I last sing? It was probably a Metallica song whilst working out on the Watt bike.
Oh, nice. Good choice. Do you play any musical instruments? Metallica. Oh yeah, Metallica, classic.
Say again.
Do you play any musical instruments?
Yes, I play the guitar.
Nice. Do you believe in ghosts?
Nope.
Any tattoos?
Nope.
If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
Predict the future.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, can't go wrong. I'll be a money earner for sure, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Right, before we go, firstly, thank you so much for giving us some of your time. I appreciate it, Greg. I know you're busy, so thank you for coming on. Is there anything that you want to plug or anything you want to let people know about before you go?
No, not really. Anyone that's in America, make sure you do an UKI. Hopefully you come to some of our big events, because I think they're pretty cool. Anyone that wants to do international agility, I'm looking at WO, and I hope you're looking at GB. If you're in the UK, I think those are two events that you'll enjoy and get the best from agility. Otherwise, no, not really into selling or plugging anything anymore. So that's quite a cool part to be in my life, that I don't have to plug and sell stuff.
Yeah, happy days. Nice. Well, yeah, thank you so much for coming on. If you want to say goodbye to everyone.
Goodbye, everyone. Nice to speak to you. Yeah. Good luck in your agility careers.
Yeah. Cheers, everyone. Speak soon. And that is the end of the podcast. Thank you for taking some time out of your day to listen. I really hope you enjoyed. If you think you might know someone else who would enjoy, feel free to pass on all the information and share the podcast with them. And get involved on any of the social media platforms. It really helps the podcast grow, and I really appreciate it. See you in the next one.